insurance companies. You can be sure that Max Weiner will be at the hearings speaking on behalf of consumers against the proposed hikes if he feels after some investigation that the rates are unnecessarily high. In 1965, before there was a strong organized national consumer movement, Max Weiner organized SEPA, the Consumer Education and Protective Association. After its first year, SEPA leaders wanted to represent consumer issues in local elections, so they formed the Consumer Party. In their first election, their mayoral candidate received 6,675 votes. They saw potential. In 76, the party received enough votes to qualify as a ballot status party, and they became Philadelphia's third party. In 79, the Consumer Party candidate for mayor won 103,000 votes, but they still have not won an election, although they hope to in the near future. Recently, Max Weiner has been speaking out against the proposed $89 million PGW rate hike. In addition to his work as a consumer advocate, Weiner, who is now 68, has been a schoolteacher, public accountant, and real estate broker. SEPA, by the way, is celebrating its 15th anniversary. Max Weiner, welcome to Fresh Air.
I'm glad to be here.
Before we talk about the issues that you're currently working on now, I'd like to talk on the occasion of its 15th anniversary a little bit about the history of SEPA. In 65, when you were first organizing SEPA, what made you think that consumer issues were important enough to build a local issue around? This was before the consumer movement had the strength that it does now.
Well, I saw the consumers as the last frontier of social organization. I saw organized labor making great strides. At that time, the civil rights movement was developing and at its height. Farmers were organized. Business and industry were well organized, but the only unorganized force in our society was the consumers. And I encountered in my own daily experience many oppressive practices to which consumers were subjected, and I realized that if consumers could be organized, they could exercise tremendous power in the marketplace and in society. And that led me, together with some incidents that occurred at that time, to begin to try to organize consumers on a real firm and sound level.
What do you think holds us together as consumers? Because we're all consumers. Even the people who raise the rates are consumers of something.
Well, it's true, but we look upon the consumers as sort of as we against them, us against them. It's true that the people who raise the rates are consumers, but we're talking about the people who pay the bills, not those who raise the rates. And we're trying to organize the bill paying, the average, ordinary, everyday bill paying consumers. We know that bank presidents, insurance executives, utility executives are also consumers, but they have very little difficulty in paying the bills that we encounter. So we concentrated our efforts primarily among the low income consumers, people to whom the actual process of consumption, obtaining the necessities of life and paying for those necessities, was often a bitter struggle, even sometimes a struggle for survival. And those consumers we consider the basis of the modern consumer movement. What we did when we organized, we developed a new concept of the consumer movement, not an organization that simply gave consumers advice on how to be a good shopper, where to get a good buy, how to find information on what to do. We realized that what consumers had to do was to organize and confront the people who control the marketplace. We realized we had to come into opposition with those who were setting the rates, making the decisions upon which and with which we had to live. So we developed a concept of consumers organized to fight back against the conditions that were imposed upon them and to develop alternatives which reflected the consumers' needs and interests as apart from the interests and of those who are putting it upon the consumers. And our policy and strategy led to many striking successes for consumers that had never been heard of before. I know we got hundreds of thousands of dollars back in refunds to consumers that had been victimized by unfair practices in the marketplace. We saved hundreds of homes from being sold at unfair sheriff sales. We exposed unscrupulous business people. We introduced legislation and got filed court suits, which actually changed the operation of the marketplace to give consumers a little bit of a fairer chance when they go out and do their shopping.
A year after you started SEPA, you also organized the companion part of the Consumer Party. Now, why bring these issues into the voting booth?
Well, precisely because they are the issues that we face in the voting booth. The very people who raise our rates, who impose the high premiums upon us, who subject us to the unscrupulous practices, they're the ones who put up the candidates and ask us to vote for them. And it didn't seem to us to make any sense to be engaged in battle with these people 365 days a year and then go into the ballot box and be compelled to vote for one or another of the choices that they offer to us. So we said, let's organize to put up our own candidates, people who are dedicated and devoted to the consumer interest, who would be able to enter an election and raise the issues that consumers were concerned about and begin to rally the consumers to make what I consider the ultimate decision, which is who controls the marketplace in our society, to give consumers an opportunity by being elected to the councils, the legislatures, Congress, and eventually to the White House, to have the power to make the decisions under which we have to live. And that only can be done by electing representatives. And that's why we organized the Consumer Party. And as you pointed out in your introduction, our first vote, some 6,000 votes, was not a great, we didn't overturn the world with that, but we proved that by identifying the consumer issues and running consumer candidates, there was a constituency which could be organized and educated to fight for its own interests. And we steadily kept at the job until, as you mentioned, in 1979, our candidate got 103,000 votes. We're the third party in the city of Philadelphia. We participate in every election now. And to give you an illustration of what that means, for instance, in the coming election, there's a candidate for city controller. The present city controller sits on the Gas Commission. He is responsible for placing the high gas rates on consumers. He voted to permit the $12 million raw material adjustment to be imposed upon us, for instance. He has covered up the horrendous scandal involved with the synthetic natural gas plant. Well, if consumers who are protesting vociferously against these conditions, if they had no one else to vote for, how would they be able to express their opposition to these conditions? Well, the Consumer Party has a candidate running in this election for that same post, and that enables consumers who are protesting against the high gas bills, who want them brought down, who want something done to alleviate their distress, it gives those consumers an opportunity to show how they feel by going in and pulling the lever to vote for the Consumer Party candidate in the coming election, whose name happens to be Lee Frizzell. So that's why we recognize that these consumer issues are really the issues that are being settled in the ballot box, but up until the time the Consumer Party arrived on the scene, they were being settled without our participation, except to vote for one of them. Now we have a chance to vote for one of our own.
As you pointed out before, you see the Consumer Party and SEPA as representing the interests of the people who can't afford to pay half their bills, people who are monetarily disenfranchised.
Not only those. There are people now who can afford to pay their bills but are having a great deal of trouble in meeting them. Remember, the people who have to pay the high gas bills also going to have to pay the increased $187 million for the electric rates. They're going to have to pay the 50% water rate increase. They're going to have to pay the $75 million insurance premium increase. So it's not only the people, for instance, on welfare who are now being hit. This problem is reaching up into the middle class. People are in distress all over, and they are beginning in increasing numbers to respond to our message that we have an interest, we have needs and wants which have to be expressed through our own organization and our own political perspectives.
Everyone knows that in politics you need money for both your advertising and to just fund the whole campaign, and it is a very expensive process. Since you are not representing the interests of the wealthy, how have you managed to get together enough money to make campaigning possible?
Well, we're out on the street. We collect nickels and dimes and dollars from consumers who interests we represent. We're not beholden to any one of the interests that we oppose. No business people, wealthy foundations or corporations contribute any money to us and tell us what to say, what to do, what to vote for. We are unqualified representing the consumers for whom we fight. And while we don't have much money, we're able to wage an effective fight. The reason those politicians need a lot of money is because they have to confuse and mislead people. And that requires a huge advertising campaign. But if you're telling the people the truth, you really don't need to have all that money, except we have to compete. We have to compete in the election campaign with people who are financed with tremendous amounts of money. Take, for instance, our own mayoralty campaign. Mayor Green right now is collecting money for his next campaign. He has a dinner. People contribute $1,000 a plate to his dinner. So he's already beginning to collect the money to run his next political campaign. Well, when he's elected mayor, whose interest do you think he represents? Does he represent the interests of the ordinary average bill-paying consumer, the gas consumer, for instance, struggling with their high bills, the SEPTA rider now faced with an increase of 10 cents on the fare? Or does he represent the interests of those wealthy people who are able to contribute $1,000 a plate to his dinner? We have no such wealthy contributors, and we're not beholden to them, and we oppose them. We fight them in the election campaign, and we fight them every day on the street in the various consumer issues we undertake.
Although how many years? 14 years.
15.
The 14 years that the party has been running candidates, nobody from the Consumer Party has won, but through the elections, there's been media visibility of you and Lee Frizzell and the other people who have run, and you've had a way of getting your analysis across to the people who read the newspapers that quote you and listen to the shows that you appear on. What's victory to you? What are some of the successes that you feel that you've had? And can you lose the battle and still kind of win? I mean, do you feel like you've won though you haven't won any elections?
I feel like many people who are active in the people's interests realize that in this kind of a fight, you lose, 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 lose until you win. It's keeping at it everlastingly, going through those defeats, which makes it possible for you to emerge victorious in the end. As long as we realize that we're representing the interests of the immense majority of the people, there is no question that eventually that majority will realize that by voting for consumers, they're voting for their best interests. It's true we don't have the money to compete with these politicians. We don't have the organization, which is built up largely upon patronage. We don't have the control of the media that they have, but neither do they represent the interests of the majority. There's no way that the candidate for city controller, who is the present incumbent, can go before consumers and say he represents their interests. They would tear him to pieces if he tried to say that, because they're so irate about these high gas bills which he helped to impose upon them. So by us recognizing that we are fighting for the consumer interest, even though we don't have enough money to get that message out, eventually, the consumers will see there's only one way in which they can help their struggle for a better condition now and a better future, to vote for the Consumer Party and to join SEPA and participate in our activity. We have a very interesting mechanism now that we're developing for the organization of large masses of consumers. For instance, we say on this gas fight, our traditional methods of struggle, what SEPA has done, we get out and we picket a merchant, we compel a merchant to give us a consumer a fair deal when they're ripped off on an automobile deal or a home improvement contract or an appliance contract, but we realize that you can't beat the gas company by a few pickets getting out in front of their place. Because when you picket a merchant, consumers have the alternative of going to some other merchant to buy their merchandise if they want to. But who else can you go and get your gas from except the gas company? So to combat a huge entity like the gas company, we realize we've got to get a majority of the consumers organized to accomplish that. And a majority of the consumers, 540,000 consumers, means at least 275,000 consumers have got to be organized to wage this fight. How do you do that? How does an organization like SEPA, without resources, no influence, no control of the media, no newspapers that we can automate, how do we accomplish that? Well, here's what we're doing. We have a campaign in which you, if you're interested in fighting the gas rates, you sign a pledge opposing the gas rate increase, and you try to get 5 additional consumers to do likewise.
It's like a chain letter.
It's not a chain letter. It's an organization. Chain letter, you can't use the mail for a chain letter. But we are building an organization in which those 5 people that you would get to join would in turn try to get 5 more. And they in turn would try to get 5 more, and that keeps growing. If you take 5 and multiply it 8 times, multiply it 8 times, we'll have enough consumers organized. And that's what we need. We say the gas company is trying to stick it to us. Without some power, we'll never be able to stick it back to them. Contrast the position of consumers with the position of organized labor. Hospital workers are now getting ready to go on strike. They have certain needs, and they formulate their demands, but they have the power with which to enforce those demands, even if it means tying up every hospital in the city. Consumers, we have our demands, but we lack the power to enforce those demands. But if we had a majority of consumers organized, we would take the necessary action, whatever that action the majority would decide, and we'd have the power to compel the authorities to listen to us.
Well, what kind of tactics are you talking about? I mean, labor walks out. What do consumers do?
Well, consumers have consumer power. We don't want to prevent the gas company from operating because we need the gas. We don't want to cut our noses off to spite our face. So consumers would have to develop those tactics which would enable us, on the one hand, to bring such tremendous pressure upon the authority with, at the same time, guaranteeing that the service continues and our supplies are met. And that requires a very skillful development of tactics, which only can be developed by a large mass of people, whatever that would be. For instance, if the majority would decide that they don't want to pay the RMA portion of the bill, the raw material adjustment portion of the bill, which has gotten many people irate and angry, they would be able to say to the Gas Commission, if you put that on us, we are not going to pay it. And we are not just a few people that can come around and shut our gas off. We are a majority. We are 275,000 strong. And there's no way you can victimize a majority because a majority rules. Whatever the majority would decide, we're not saying that that's what they will do, but whatever they decide, they'll have the power to guarantee that that will be done. And anyone interested in getting into this campaign can call our office at HA4-1441. We'll send you one of our pledge sheets. You sign. You get 5 people to sign. Send it back to us. We'll send them a membership card and the Consumer Action Committee and a pledge sheet, and that's the way it goes. Each person is asked to contribute a single dollar, which covers our cost of mailing and keeping in touch with them.
So you're talking about the PGW rate hikes. Now, when you're lobbying on an issue like this or any other proposed utility rate hike, what kind of research do you do beforehand so that you have so that you're confident that the rate hike is indeed unjust? Where do you go to find out your information?
Well, a lot of people get stuck on that idea. Where we go is to the consumers. We talk to consumers. Every day we're on the street talking to thousands of consumers. They're signing petitions. They're signing our pledges. What these consumers are telling us is that they cannot afford to pay the increasing rates. And that's enough for us to bring to the Gas Commission what our demands are. The PGW comes to the Gas Commission and says, we need more money. And then the Gas Commission gives them more money. We want to be able to come to the Gas Commission and say, hey, we can't afford to pay anymore, and we expect you to listen to us. Heretofore, they don't listen to us. In fact, they don't pay any attention to the fact that we have needs. They only pay attention to those who are asking us to pay more money. That's why we've got to get the consumers organized. If we were organized, we had the majority of consumers organized, then we would have the resources to employ experts to give us the best advice that we would need so that we would be able to formulate our policy and our program in our best interest. At present, all we can do is say, what do the consumers want? let's organize to try to accomplish that.
So you're saying that it's not really relevant whether the company actually needs that money or not. What's relevant is that you can't afford to pay it.
That's what we consider the most relevant thing. There's no denying the fact that everybody needs more money, but so do we need more money, and we don't have the money. The consumers are the lowest people on the totem pole. Everybody passes their rate increases on to us, and nobody even considers what the other rate increase is being requested. The gas company doesn't say, hey, we can't do this now because the electric company just got $187 million, or the telephone company got $100 million. No, they all jump in and bite our flesh like a shark and run away regardless of the effect upon us.
Let's look at the proposed SEPTA rate hike for a minute. It's proposed now that the rates be upped by a dime, which would bring it to 75 cents mm-hmm. for a ride on SEPTA. Now, everybody has been reading about what dire financial straits SEPTA is in, and we know that federal support is being phased out for SEPTA, and I think it's fair to say that all of us, or at least most of us, rely on public transportation, and it would be very difficult to have a functioning city without it. Who compromises in a situation like this?
Well,
it's such a complex situation. You were saying it's us against them, but something like public transportation, it's not that simple anymore.
You're right when you say without transportation, we can't have a functioning city. But is the city only consumers? Are we the only ones who have to bear the burden of keeping the city functioning with transportation? Don't the business people need a functioning city in order to do business? During the last strike, they lost $3 million a day, only proved how vital SEPTA was to their existence. When we asked them, how about you contributing some share at the fare box to keep SEPTA in operation, they turned a deaf ear. So we know SEPTA needs money. SEPTA needs a lot of money. And we have made a proposal as to where that money is to come from. We say that if the business people would contribute 1 cent out of every dollar of their payroll to a fund to operate SEPTA, we would obtain $170 million a year, which would enable us to vastly improve the service, reduce the fares, and make it possible for SEPTA to function as a truly mass transit system with many more people riding the system, with all the benefits that has for a functioning city and improvements for the business community. But since the business people are organized, since they are the ones who fund the candidates who get elected to the legislature who do their bidding, and since the riders and consumers are not organized, our proposals are not listened to, and they put it upon us.
In the past 15 years that you've been in SEPA and organizing it, what are some of the tactics that you've given up on and found to be ineffective, although you had hoped that they'd get a good response?
Well, we have not given up on any of our tactics. We've simply applied our tactics to new situations. If you're a consumer who gets ripped off by an automobile dealer, for instance, we have learned the proper tactics to deal with that situation. You, together with other volunteers in our organization, will try to negotiate with that automobile dealer for a just settlement of your complaint. And we settle hundreds of complaints just by negotiation. But where the dealer is stubborn and simply thinks because he has a superior position in the marketplace, he can enforce his will, we would get out and picket that dealer. When we begin picketing, we restore that balance of power, and we compel many such dealers to justify a consumer complaint. We have not abandoned that at all. This is a daily bit of SEPA's operation. But we have found that that type of tactic is not adequate when you're dealing with the electric company, the gas company, with SEPTA. You can't change SEPTA's operations by a few pickets. You can't get the gas company to accede to your demands by a few pickets. There's no other gas company that consumers can deal with, so we have to have a development of our tactics to meet the changing situation, and that means we need consumers organized in vast numbers. That's the thing that we're trying to develop now. When we get that, we'll apply the same tactics with these vast numbers as we now do to a small individual consumer complaint in the marketplace.
Now, one obvious tactic that I know a lot of different kinds of groups have tried is meeting with the executives at the company that you have a problem with, whether it's a utility company or an insurance company or whatever, but trying to organize a meeting with the person with the most power who you can have access to. Have you found that to be an effective way of working for change?
No. Frequently, when consumers try to get to these top executives, they can't even get to them. These top executives are shielded by a whole array of people who prevent them from getting access, who act as a buffer and a shield to deal with consumer complaints, consumer relations departments, and things of that sort. And we have found if you want to deal with somebody at the top, you put a picket line in front of that establishment, and somebody from the top is going to emerge. You don't even have to know the person's name. They'll put out somebody who can negotiate with you and make the decisions. So meeting with the executives, we do that. Whenever we have a consumer complaint, we make efforts to sit down and negotiate. And as I said, I'd say 75% of our consumer complaints are settled through that method. But where consumers can't get it settled through that way, what other alternative do they have? Well, we have provided that alternative through consumer action in the marketplace.
Now, there's also usually public hearings, particularly for utilities, before a rate is increased, and the public is invited to come and speak their mind, and you're usually there. Do you feel like you're listened to and that what you say is considered?
No, not at all. In fact, the SEPTA decision is an example of that. Here you have an examiner employed by SEPTA, paid by SEPTA to conduct a public hearing at which everyone who attends opposes the fare increase, students and riders, and yet he comes out with a decision which gives SEPTA even more than they themselves asked for. He comes out with a decision which will give SEPTA more money than SEPTA requested in the rate increase they did ask for. So even though you appear at the hearings, and last year during the SEPTA hearings, we had thousands of people who turned out. But the SEPTA board, which is not composed of consumers, makes their own decisions, and we don't have the power of decision. That's where the big weakness of the consumers lies. We don't have the power to make the decisions. And I don't consider that getting on the board is the essential thing. I consider that organizing the consumers as an independent majority force, that's the essential thing, and that's what SEPA is about right now, getting the consumers organized in a majority.
What do you consider your greatest victories to be?
Well, we have won some really outstanding victories. For instance, there used to be a procedure whereby they had a confession, a judgment note. Person knocked on your door, sold you a television, rugs, appliances, and you signed a contract which contained what is called a confession of judgment. That confession of judgment meant that you waived any legal rights that you had to oppose that merchant if there was anything wrong with the transaction. And that led to sheriff sales on a wide scale. It led to huge rip-offs. The most unscrupulous people went into business and used that confession of judgment note to swindle, cheat, rob consumers billions of dollars. Well, we fought that for years. And finally, we went into court, and we got the federal court in Philadelphia to declare that law unconstitutional. 163-year-old confession of judgment law in the state of Pennsylvania was overturned by our action in court, so that now you can't have a confession of judgment for low-income consumers, that is. If a merchant or a bank thinks that you owe them money, they can't automatically set the sheriff on you and sell your goods and merchandise or home. They have to file a suit in a court and give you a chance to oppose that and defend yourself, which you didn't have before. So we consider one of our greatest victories. We also eliminated the holder in due course, which was a companion doctrine that the banks used when you approach the bank and said, hey, this thing the guy sold me doesn't work, or it's not what he promised. The bank would say, look, we have nothing to do with that. We're the holder in due course of the contract. We want you to pay us. If you don't, we'll set the sheriff on you. That has been outlawed as a result of our campaigning and the campaigning of others. A bank can no longer say that. If they finance a contract and there's something wrong with that contract, you may now stop your payments to the bank, and before the bank can proceed against you, they have to file a lawsuit in the court and give you a chance to explain why you don't want to pay, because either the merchandise is defective, the contractor didn't know what he was supposed to do, or some other legitimate reason. Well, that has those two victories, eliminating confession of judgments, wiping out the holder in due course, has actually transformed the operation of the marketplace to make it a fairer, safer place for consumers to shop.
And what are your immediate and long-range goals? Now, you've talked about organizing consumers and the importance of having that power when people come together, and you've talked about the proposed PGW hikes and the proposed SEPTA hikes.
I'd say that our immediate goal is to obtain a plan for consumers to get representation. You know, labor, workers, when they want to get a union organized, they file a petition with the National Labor Relations Board, and if enough workers vote in an election, the employer must recognize that union. We want a similar plan for consumers. If consumers file a petition with a consumer representation board, that entity, like the gas company, electric company, telephone, whatever the entity is, must conduct an election in which the consumers served by that entity have a chance to vote. Do you want to be represented by a consumer organization? Would you contribute $1 to fund that organization? If a majority vote yes, that entity must then recognize consumers, and consumers would then be organized on a mass scale, would have the same power that organized labor has to defend its interests. That's one of our immediate goals. In addition, of course, we realize that getting consumers elected into public office is one of the most important ways in which we can protect the consumer's interest.
Okay. This is a pretty interesting model that you've set up in Philadelphia. Have people from other cities come in to look at SEPA and the Consumer Party?
Our model has been used extensively all over the country. Branches of our organization were set up in many cities. They functioned for a while. We didn't have the resources as a center of organization to keep that going, but other organizations picked up our methods and tactics and strategy and are using that. The Consumer Party now is on the ballot, is running for election in Allegheny County in Pennsylvania and in Centre County in Pennsylvania, and it's spreading. We are affiliated nationally with the Citizens Party, which is trying to elect people all over the country. In fact, elected a person to the school board in one city in New England. So what we have shown as the method of consumers to fight for their interests, both economically and politically, is being spread throughout the country. And the day is not far off, I can assure you. As the crisis mounts and things are being imposed upon the consumers of such an outrageous nature. You know, if President Reagan succeeds in his plan of decontrolling the price of natural gas, our gas bills are going to double and triple. Now, there's no way that millions of consumers are going to be without gas, unable to heat their homes. You're talking about a basic human necessity for adequate shelter. And when things like that happen, more and more consumers are going to recognize their interests, organize, and politically fight to protect those interests.
Max Wiener, I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. Max Wiener is the founder of SEPA, the Consumer Education and Protective Association, and of the Consumer Party. And this year, SEPA celebrates its 15th anniversary. Max Wiener, thanks for being here this afternoon.
You're welcome.
It's 22 minutes to 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Just a few minutes on Fresh Air, my guest will be Cher Height, and we're going to be talking about her new study on male sexuality. At 4 o'clock on Fresh Air, my guests will be Joyce Carol Oates and Raymond Smith. And on Interval today at 3:30, the subject will be some of the out-of-print work of pianist and composer Andrew Hill. Today is the 68th birthday of Sammy Kahn. So we wish him a happy birthday, and here he is from an album that he made singing his own composition. He wrote the lyrics to this, and it's called I Should Care.
Maybe I won't find someone as lovely as you, but I should care. I should go around weeping. I should care. I should go without sleeping. Strangely enough, I sleep well, except for a dream or two. But then I count my sheep well. Funny how sheep can lull you to sleep. So I should care. I should let it upset me. I should care. But it just doesn't get me. Maybe I won't find someone as charming as you, but I should care, and I do.
Tell myself that I'm so lucky to be loving you. So lucky to be the one you run to see. The day is through. I only know what I know. The passing years will show. You've kept my love so young, so new.
Frank Sinatra singing Time After Time, which also had lyrics by Sammy Kahn, and we opened with Sammy Kahn singing his own tune, I Should Care. Today, Sammy Kahn celebrates his 68th birthday. It's 16 minutes to 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Cher Hite has written a follow-up to her book, The Hite Report on Female Sexuality. In the introduction to The Hite Report on Male Sexuality, she writes, quote, "Intercourse is at once one of the most beautiful, at the same time most oppressive and exploitative acts of our society." She also writes, quote, "To discuss sex is to discuss our most basic views of who we are and what we want life to be and what kind of society we believe in," unquote. The Hite Report on Male Sexuality has just been published by Knopf. Cher Hite is my guest. We'll be talking, frankly, about sexual attitudes and practices. If you think this discussion will make you or anyone you're listening with uncomfortable, you might want to tune out for a while and rejoin us at about 3:30 for this week's edition of Interval. Cher Hite, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
What were some of the key things that you wanted to find out about male attitudes towards sex and men's feelings about their own bodies?
Well, it seemed that if the implication of the women's book was the study of women that I did several years ago was that women would like to see sexuality different, change, then was it true that the way we define sex now is the way men want it to be defined, or is it a cultural heritage that's come down and that men feel they must continue? How do individual men feel while they're, quote, performing the sex act as we know it?
What surprised you most when you read the responses that you got?
Well, I've been doing it for so long, I don't know if I personally could say I was surprised, but going with the cultural stereotypes, there are many surprises that go against those stereotypes. For example, the culture definitely seems to believe that men need intercourse with women, that is, the penis and the vagina, because that's the best orgasm. That's men's main outlet for orgasm, and it's the best orgasm for men. But when men were asked, why do you like intercourse, surprisingly, most said, well, I don't need it for the orgasm. I can have a better orgasm, at least physically, by myself. Then they went on to say why they did want intercourse. And most of them said that there was a kind of closeness you could get during intercourse that they didn't feel you could get elsewhere. Now, that might not mean that they couldn't get that closeness during other sex acts. It's just that they defined sex so closely as intercourse that they tended to use the two words interchangeably. But they felt that you could get more body contact during sex than you could otherwise, because men are not supposed to ask for closeness and cuddling. They felt that during sex they were allowed to be more emotional, that it wasn't unmanly to be emotional during sex, although it was unmanly to be overly emotional, whatever overly might mean, at other times. And finally, most men felt that if you weren't having intercourse pretty frequently, you weren't really a man.
You, I know, are interested in feminism and its effects on people's sexual relationships. Can you compare for us how women felt that the women's movement had affected them sexually and in their sexual relationships, and compare that to how men felt feminism had affected them?
Well, feminism could mean that women felt they had a right to define their own identity rather than it being defined by a male-dominated culture. So feminism could mean many things for many people, but I suppose that could be an overall definition. Sexually, that might mean that women, you see, in the first study, it showed that most women didn't orgasm from intercourse per se, but most women did orgasm easily from masturbation or clitoral stimulation. The society has always said women have a, quote, problem with orgasm during intercourse, and men were more sexual because they could orgasm so easily. But the fact is women orgasm as easily as men with the right stimulation. But the society hasn't wanted to accept that, has wanted to continue the definition of sex as we know it. So perhaps a woman might want to assert her own sexual feelings or explore how she might like to share her body with whomever, her husband or her partner. And how that might affect a man is another topic. I mean, men, when asked about clitoral stimulation, most men were very unfamiliar with it. Most men still thought women should orgasm from intercourse and felt very pressured and put upon to, quote, that old word, perform intercourse in just the right way to, quote, make her come. The same way men are supposed to bring home the bacon, they're supposed to give the woman the orgasm. And
you're saying they saw that as being another job to perform?
Yes, and they talked about having to do most of the work during foreplay. things like that. And that's why most men, even though they had sex with a partner frequently, if they did, they still had frequent masturbation by themselves, because that was their time for themselves. Whereas the stereotype has been that intercourse is for men. And in a way, intercourse is for men, since men get A, the orgasm, and B, the symbolic maleness, the acceptance that you get as a man during intercourse. But still, they felt very conflicted about it.
I think in the preface, define sex as being inherently political. What I say by that, let me find the quote that I'm referring to. Intercourse is at once one of the most beautiful and at the same time most oppressive and exploitative acts of our society. That's a quote from your preface. And one of your questions in the men's questionnaire is, do you think, I hope I get this right, do you think that sex is a political act? Or, no, it has political connotations, something like that.
Well, it does, absolutely. And I think what women were suggesting in the first study was not that they didn't like intercourse, but that intercourse symbolized certain things. And if intercourse became a choice, and I'll get to what it symbolizes in a minute, but if intercourse became a choice, then that would be what they would prefer. But as it is, intercourse is not a choice. For example, in marriage, intercourse is legally, the woman has to have intercourse if the husband asks for it in most states. That was the famous is there rape in marriage case. Legally, it's, women were owned by men in marriage up until not that long ago, and now they still have the laws about access to intercourse. And, of course, the birth control issue fits into that, whether or not a woman, how much access does the man have, after all? Can he implant his seed whenever he would like or not? Intercourse, you see, the definition of sex that is something called foreplay, which I always put in quotes, because why does it have to be before something, followed by what clinicians call vaginal penetration, which it sounds like the vagina is stationary and the penis would be the thing that was moving, and ending with